Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to A Real Point of View, everybody. This is Greg Morgan, your host, and I'm joined by my co-host, Miss Karen D., the movie maven. And in just a moment, we're going to bring our guest on. We're having a little technical difficulty, so give us one moment, and we'll get started.
TopezN93@gmail.com.
Okay, thank you. Without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on our guest here on Real Point of View here. Basically, we wanted to go back and do a revisit on Rebel Kings, which was a documentary about basically the gang essence back in the 60s and the mid to late 70s. And what better way to do that is to bring someone who actually lived through it and lived it, and that's Loy Topez Murphy. Hey, Loy, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, good. Just a kind of a brief introduction, kind of give us kind of an overview as to what it was like living in the in New York at the time, and I guess my first question for you would be, why get into the gang at all? What was the purpose?
Can you still hear me? Because we're not on the phone. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Hold on a moment. Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. First of all, Rebel Kings is more than just a documentary about gangs. Rebel Kings is a story about it's about a peace treaty that brought forth the Greek creation of the hip hop culture. So, you know, it's not just what gang and all of this stuff. It's really more about a peace treaty and how the hip hop culture began, which has become a worldwide multi-billion-dollar industry. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay.
From those things, it's an echo, and I apologize. I don't know why it's doing that.
Yeah.
So this is Karen talking as well, Movie Maven. So you said it's more than a documentary, and it certainly seemed like it was more than a documentary. It really chronicled something that was extremely unique in terms of just the way that all of these different, significant events, violent events, occurred. And I guess one of the questions that I had, one thing that struck me when I looked at the documentary was how many of the former gang members spent their lives after the gang as community activists. You, after being an Olympic athlete, became a police officer and, worked a significant amount of time in your life as a police officer. So, again, community service. Do you think community activism became cool after the Rubble Kings?
I don't know what you mean by that, but let me kind of throw you off a little bit and talk about, because you talk about gangs, but let's talk about how it all started, because we didn't start off as gangs. It's not like we woke up one morning and said, let's make a gang, that'll be really cool. It's not the way it happened. So let me just give you a kind of outline of what happened. But even before I do that, let me just shout out to everybody so we can get out the way. Rubble Kings is directed by director Shan Nicholson, who worked very, very, very hard, doing these interviews and getting all the clearances to get this feature out. It actually been eight years labor of love for him to get this out, and I applaud him and congratulate him for being the one to actually allow us to tell our stories, which was very painful for a lot of us. It was narrated by John Leguizamo, produced by Dino Montel, Michael Aguilar, funny man Jim Carrey, who you all know, Christina Ortiz, Ben Velez, producers Nick Quested and David Kennedy, a guy named Lil Shalimar, great guy who did the music for the presentation, Roxini, who's the first lady of Rubble Kings, Jeff Chang, my man King Class, Assassinators of Brooklyn, shout out to Benji Melendez from the Ghetto Brothers, Africa and Bambaataa to the Black Spades and the Zulu Nation, Blackie, the president of the Savage Skulls, Karate Charlie, DSR from the Savage Nomads, rest in peace, former mayor of New York City, Ed Koch, Felipe Luciano, who started the Young Lords Movement and also was a member of the Last Poets, Harlem Coley from the Harlem Turks, Jazzy J, G. Sanchez from the Black Spades, father of hip-hop, Kool Herc, Lori Vallon, Marshall Berman, No-No from the Assassinators of Brooklyn, Red Alert, the president of the Imperial Bachelors, Rolando Ruiz, and I'm Topaz. I also want to give a shout-out to my boys in the south of France, Estee, Ebony Dukes, and Pays in Sweden. Now, I want to start with talking about how this all began. We began as a block crew like a lot of gangs. But just so you get a better understanding of why we call ourselves family and why, we had the dedication to each other, because you got to understand, I moved to Hewitt Place when I was 5 years old. So most of these guys, we grew up together. We grew up on Hewitt Place. And if you don't know what Hewitt Place is the location that they filmed the movie Beach Street, just to give you a background of what Hewitt Place was. So we grew up as kids playing street games. We played games like red light, green light, 1, 2, 3, tag, stickball. We played a game called Skelzies, where we drew boxes in the ground and, we put basically bubble gum inside of bottle caps. And, the object of the game was to shoot these bottle caps into the specific boxes. We played games like off the wall, slugs, handball, flying kites. We actually, we flew kites with razor blades on them. So, we would cut other kites down, and, we would have this saying, we would yell, hoota, hoota, and whoever caught the kite, it was their kite. So that's how we became a family. We didn't just all of a sudden, we're going to be a gang. We played together, we lived together. We suffered through poverty together. you know, we watched people die. You know, there was a lot of things that led up to us even becoming, you know, block crews, you know, the Hewitt Place boys. Like I said, we played gangs. I mean, we played games, you know, in the neighborhood, just regular neighborhood games. And that's how we really became a family. We didn't, and in those days, you know, we had respect for elders where, you know, everybody in the neighborhood parent was a parent. You know, anybody's mother could go upside your head because that's just the way it was. You know, we respected everybody. So the first thing that was born in us was, you know, we learned how to love each other and we learned how to respect each other because, like I said, everybody's parent was a parent. You know, if I disrespected somebody, you know, somebody's mother would go upside my head and they tell my mother, and when she got the news, she'd go upside my head too. So we were a family that way. And that's how we became a block crew. We didn't just decide one day we're going to be gangs. You know, you're talking about kids, you know, that grew up together on the street, and we played games together. And the girls played double dutch, basically. And we even played games with the girls, games like Run, Catch, and Kiss, where, you know, we would chase the girls, and whatever girl you caught, you got to kiss her, and then we'd turn it around, and the girls would chase us, and whoever they caught, they would be able to kiss. And, of course, the girl always chased the guy that she liked the most, so that was that. So that's basically how we became family. We didn't become family, though, we're going to be a gang. We became families basically by playing street games. And like I said, I can't speak for all gangs, but I'm just telling you this is how we started.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you for telling us that. So that was how you got started.
Yeah, that's how we got started as a family. Because you gotta understand, we call gangs family. You call them gangs, we call them families.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. And then there's this extended family, really.
So it's not like, so let me just get this straight. So it's not like I'm going to join a gang. You're already family. So basically all you do is name your family, which we named ourselves, you know, the Hewitt Place Boys.
Okay. And
go ahead, Karen.
No, you can go ahead, Greg.
Okay, and I get that. I think Karen and I, we're from Chicago, so we kind of understand the. It's really kind of similar to the adding style, and it was a community, and a lot of us grew up and know a lot of people in our neighborhood. We had the block club. We had in our area was Maple Park Homeowners Association. It was just a group of families. Kind of sharing everything, being very much community, but that doesn't translate into for us anyway. Going from that necessarily to the gang, what invoked the gang? Part of what I heard you mention in the documentary was being in the gang. It was something that you had to do. So, how did it go from everybody playing and being?
You know, first of all. I sent you some. I sent you a video about Fort Apache. Did you check it out?
Last night.
Yes,
okay,
I did too.
Okay, so you understand. We're not talking about the suburbs here. We're talking about a very dangerous environment. You know. You know, and I'll tell you something. Really, gangs wasn't the most dangerous thing out there in the South Bronx. I think the most dangerous thing in the South Bronx in those days was really. Heroin addicts. Unlike crack addicts, heroin addicts, crack addicts were really skinny, so a lot of them really, you know, they couldn't defend themselves. But heroin addicts, you know, they would kill their own parents, and there was a serious heroin epidemic going on at the time where, you know, I mean, you would get robbed for 15 cents, you know. I mean, you could be killed. I mean, even in terms of the Bronx burning for those 10 years, most of that was heroin addicts being paid off by landlords setting, you know, these buildings on fire. And we almost actually got, you know, killed in a fire because some junkie came in and robbed our house and set our house on fire. And, you know, I got rescued by a fireman. So, you know, this is all the stuff we live. So it wasn't like, oh, yeah, you know, we got a great neighborhood. We're going to make gangs. Like I said, a lot of it was because of necessity, because of the dangers that we live with every day. You know, we just united and decided that, listen, And we didn't try to take over New York City, at least not at that time. Basically, all we did was, we're going to defend our block. And really, if you were caught out there alone, you were in trouble. Because, like I said, they would rob you for 15 cents, and they wouldn't have a problem, you know, killing you for a tuna fish sandwich. It was just a desperate time of poverty and oppression in the Bronx at that time. So, like I said, you had to be in the gang in a sense that you needed some kind of protection. You couldn't, and there were guys that were out there solo, but they weren't young guys like us. They were like the guys in their 20s. You know, a lot of them were a lot more dangerous than we were, but, you know, they were old enough and they knew the ropes of the streets on how to survive. But understanding, once again, you're talking about teenagers. These are teenage gangs you're talking about. You're not talking about guys in their 20s. You're talking about guys, you know, these guys in gangs 5 years old, and they weren't, and they would kill you just as a 13-year-old would. So, and like I said, the environment, we didn't create the environment. We lived in the environment. And one of the reasons why we all agreed to do Rebel Kings, because we survived the environment, and we wanted people to know that we survived. And basically, you know, we survived because of each other.
Right.
So, like I said, we didn't plan the violence. It was around us. It was all around us. So we responded to the violence. We didn't, and you know, as gangs kind of got out of control and gangs actually, you know, began to expand, we didn't try to expand because we had no, like I said, at least at that time, when we were still the Hewitt Place boys, we were not trying to expand. Basically, Hewitt Place was Westchester Avenue, Hewitt Place to Longwood Avenue, and then it intersected with 161st Street. So we weren't trying to expand and take over Bronx. We were just trying to keep our own block safe at that time anyway.
So did it evolve into something?
Well, the Hewitt Place boys evolved into the Ebony Dukes, but, you know, I mean, that'll change the story. So where do you, you know, you want me to go to how we became the Ebony Dukes, which is a whole nother, that's another aspect of it, which was some of the pioneers of the graffiti movement, but we didn't call ourselves graffiti, we called ourselves writers. So if you want me to talk about that, I can go into that. Would you like me to speak about that now?
Get into it a little bit. I mean, I just like anything else, kind of an overview.
Well, let me say this. The Hewitt Place boys, our president was Bobby Guyton at the time. So when we became the Ebony Dukes, you know, we got a new president who was a guy named Staff, who was actually in the Ghetto Brothers. Staff, Super Slick, who was in the Savage Skulls. Me and Dynamite, and actually Dynamite's uncle, who was he was in the original Ebony Dukes, which was a 1940s gang. Really, the Ebony Dukes started as a gang in 1940. One of the original members, whose name was Birdie, we asked permission from him. Actually, Ed asked some permission to use the name the Ebony Dukes. And he gave permission, so that's why we changed our name. And another thing I want to say about those times, you know, this was a time when street fighting was popular. You know, we didn't do, I mean, there was gunplay, but that's not really the major way we handled things. You know, we handled things hand-to-hand combat, which is why we all took karate. We all became boxers. I mean, well, I became boxers because basically, but your first line of defense was your body, and you use your body as a weapon because really shooting people wasn't, I mean, like I said, people got shot, but your first line of defense in the South Bronx was definitely your hands and your feet. And then later on, we used weapons like nunchucks and you know, we even used belt buckles. You know, I got hit in the head with a belt buckle before. So, you know, it wasn't just, oh, you know, just shooting each other. I mean, whatever guys are doing today, I don't know. But we basically, and being that type of environment where it was hand-to-hand combat, you know, a lot of beasts were squashed because of guys fighting one-on-one. You know, everything wasn't, oh, you know, you did something to my man and we're going to war. A lot of that stuff was just, okay, you know, so-and-so got a beef with so-and-so. You guys get together, you fight a one-on-one, and at the end of the day, you shook hands. So, you know, however people think it is, I'm just telling you how it really was. You know, a lot of stuff was settled with just hand-to-hand combat, which is why you got guys like Karate Charlie who studied martial arts and guys like me who just, you know, I wanted to know everything there was about karate, kung fu, boxing, you name it. I wanted to learn it. And, you know, actually, one of the president of the Hewitt Place boys, Bobby, you know, he was good with his hands. So he taught me a lot of moves. And I picked up, you know, karate moves from my brother. And, you know, Karate Charlie taught guys. And I learned from them. And I just tried to pick up everything, you know, I could find out about fighting because that was the main way we handled beefs, you know. And you had to know how to fight at least two or three guys. You couldn't just, you know how to fight one guy. You had to know at least how to fight at least three guys at a time. Because most of the time when they came at you, it wasn't just one guy. So you had to know how to do these things to survive. Because it wasn't all about, you know, guns all the time. It was more street fighting. So street fighting became popular in New York City at the time because that's what we did. We fought. I'm not saying nobody didn't get shot because people did get shot.
Okay, I do have a couple questions. One of the things I want to think about what was going on with you at the time is worst case scenarios and best case scenarios. So what was the worst case scenario when it came down to having to defend yourself as far as being with your brothers? What was the worst case scenario? And then after that, the best case scenario being a part of that community, being a part of that brotherhood.
I think the worst case scenario was being solo. That was the worst case scenario, being caught out there with no protection. Most of the time when you're with people, and the whole thing about it, you know, that's the whole thing about Hewitt Place. You know, the safest place you were on your own block because, you know, you didn't violate other people's territory. That was an unwritten rule. You just didn't do it. I mean, unless you wanted something to happen to you. So basically, we kept to ourselves on Hewitt Place. In fact, that's why there's so many games we played on Hewitt Place because of the reason why we didn't want to be disrespectful. Hewitt Place, we on Hewitt Place. We got Savage Skulls on Hewitt Place. We got Ghetto Brothers on Hewitt Place. Basically, the Ghetto Brothers clubhouse, one block away from ours. You know, Savage Skulls around the corner. Actually, even the Black Panthers had a clubhouse one block away from us. So, and really, the Black Panthers a lot of times were the security of the neighborhood. And when the Black Panthers started to die down, that kind of left a void where the gangs kind of took over the security of the neighborhood. So it wasn't like, you know, we were fighting within the neighborhood because we really didn't, for the most part, the Savage Skulls and the Ghetto Brothers, we got along with. Because like I said, guys lived on the block. So, you know, we had some minor disagreements, but all of that was solved diplomatically. But I would say the worst case scenario in those days, which is why I said in the movie, you know, you had to be in a gang because, like I said, if you got out there, caught out there solo, and I'm talking about young guys, because, like I said, you're going to have a lot of people, like my older brother. My older brother wasn't in a gang. You know, he was out there. He was a black belt in karate, and nobody messed with him. But then again, he was a little older than us. So I'm talking about guys my age. You know, I'm talking about 71. I was 13. So, you know, it was really a teenager thing. The leaders, you know, they were like 17, 18. There were leaders that were 16 years old. But the leaders were like in their late teens. But we're talking about teenage gangs here. So, you know, kind of get a perspective of the age. And you're talking about very dangerous teenage guys that would do contract murders for $50. So you're not just talking about, oh, teenage little kids. You're talking about very dangerous kids in a very dangerous part of New York City. Best case scenario is that, you know, you had a one-on-one fight, you won or the other person won, and then you shook hands and it was over. There wasn't no, I'm coming back because you beat me. There was just, you know, it was respect given to where the main thing was that you would have enough courage to fight. If you didn't fight, then you're going to be abused. But as long as you had enough courage to at least fight, it didn't matter really if you won or lost in those days. It just mattered that you stepped up to the plate and, you know, you did what you had to do.
What you describe as life in gangs, having to be in gangs, sounds different than the way we perceive gangs today.
That's the way you perceive gangs. That's why I'm here to tell you how it really went down.
I mean, the gangs that are operating today.
I have nothing to do with the gangs that are operating today. I do not agree with their mentality. I do not agree with their, you know, and I don't call them gangs because you're talking about, you know, guys that are like 10 guys. That's not a gang to me. That's a crew. That's really a posse. You know, gangs in the Bronx, we have hundreds of guys, thousands of guys. You know, I don't even think they could ever be that large because they don't love and respect each other. So you're not talking about a bunch of guys that are out there, you know, selling drugs. That's not what we did. That's not how we roll. Gangs today, I hear about them selling drugs. I can't speak for them because I don't know what they do. But I can tell you that, you know, without the two main ingredients of a real gang, which is love and respect, you're not going to have no growth because who wants to join up to a bunch of people that only got two places to go? That's dead or jail. That's what happens when you start selling drugs, dead or jail. Choose one.
Right.
Our gangs grew by thousands. Our gangs grew by the thousands because, like I said, we were more protectors of our community as opposed to, you know, today's gangs, which really a lot of people don't understand Rebel King because a lot of people look at Rebel King, they think they're watching a movie. But you're watching a documentary. Guys just basically, listen, this is what happened. And it's made to educate. Actually, you know, the first purpose for us making Rebel Kings, I never thought Rebel Kings would turn into something that was on a movie screen. Our first intention for making Rebel Kings was to make a documentary for at-risk youth in New York City. Now, how that grew from that was, Tribeca Film, basically, Robert De Niro's organization, they liked the movie and they said, okay, we want to show this film to 250 at-risk youth of a program they ran. So it went really well. And after that, it's like people just started hopping on board and this thing just started growing and growing and growing. And, you know, funny man Jim Carrey got involved and, you know, it became what it is today, but it didn't start out that way. It basically was just a bunch of guys trying to help kids learn that, listen, there's no purpose in all of this killing. And that's what we had to learn. You know, there was a lot of beefs over stupidness, and basically the purpose of the movie, you know, it wasn't to promote violence or all this kind of stuff, which people, you know, America is so, you know, they're so drama ridden right now to where everything got to be drama. So they look at it like just another, oh, this movie, you know, it, whatever. Like I said, we're talking about a documentary here that we did to help at-risk youth come to a place where they can do what we did, to where they came together because of the death of Black Benji, which was very painful. You know, it was very painful for me to watch the movie the first couple of times. And actually, Rebel Kings itself was very educational for me because a lot of things happened back then that I didn't even know. You know, I didn't know it until I saw the movie and I talked to Yellow Benji and I said, I didn't even know you guys went and talked to Gwendolyn, who was, you know, Black Benji's mother. I had no idea. I didn't know. I just was expecting a war, but then all of a sudden the war stopped and they told him about a peace treaty. I had no idea how that happened. So even myself who was there, I was educated by the movie. And that's what the movie is meant to do. It's meant to educate a lot of these kids out here. And we're trying to stop the violence in the hood. So, you know, I mean, we're welcome. Anybody got better ideas? You know, everybody's talking about, oh, you know, you people got to do something. Well, you know, we are trying to do something. And anybody else that want to get on board and try to do something about the violence in the hood, because nobody really cares if you want to be honest about it. You know, I mean, who's really trying to do something about the violence in the hood? You know, you don't. I mean, even, you know, you look on the news, okay, another black kid shot another black kid. You know, they go to the next story and whatever. But we really wanted to do something here to try to talk to our youth because we figured that, you know, some of the guys that actually know what it is to live that type of life of violence to come forward and say, listen, we already know where you guys are going. You guys are going on a road that leads nowhere. That's basically where you're going. So we're going to tell you already before you have to keep going down that road, It's a dead end street.
Right.
So what we'd like to do is like to transition over into the Blog Talk Radio, from Blog Talk Radio over into Google Plus and Hangouts on Air. So I've sent an invite to our speaker tonight, Lloyd Topaz Murphy, and hopefully everyone else can try to join us over on Google Plus, Hangouts on Air. Okay, so we'll be disconnecting from and I sent out an invitation for you, Lloyd, so hopefully you've got that, and we'll see you momentarily.